Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
And this is part two. Last week, or last episode, we talked about, and it was prompted from an ASQ Reliability Division, Reliability and Risk Division newsletter that had sample questions from the CRE. And Kirk and I both, I had 10 questions, sample questions. And it sparked for us this notion that, I think Kirk, your quote to me in the email was, why are they still stuck in the 80s? And I would go even further back, because the what I call parts count, you know, the prediction methodologies and the use of the exponential assumption goes back to the 60s.
Yeah, and constant failure rates and all that.
So the point is, and we talked about a little bit about why that's a problem. It's just institutionalized. It's for organizations in military contracts, they can sell they make money selling spare parts and doing repairs and making improvements. They don't make money on the first design. So they have no incentive to do it. And then there's software companies and all kinds of consultants and stuff that go, oh, I'll do that prediction for you, or I'll do that calculation for you. And it's really dirt simple. And it's
dirt simple and worthless.
Less than worthless because you're paying for it.
Less than worthless, right. It may misdirect you to focus on the wrong, by cooling some component because your activation energy and your fit rate is too high.
Yeah, and then you put a fan in there.
I've seen this in real life, you know, in a real design group.
We ended the last episode with, we recognize that there's this problem, right? And that it's systemic. It's not just a simple problem. It's in textbooks. It's in standards. It's in bodies of knowledge for certification. It's in common practice. What do we do to stop that? How do you break that cycle so that people know and understand when to use exponential, which is very rare, in my opinion, or understand the perils of using a prediction method that's just bogus? If it's so supported all these different places, why? How do people judge when and why to use a particular tool or activity?
When it shows benefit, when you've actually, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, in this paper, Reliability by the U.S. Army and Dagonta Goss at Cowles was written, called Reliability Prediction, a Continued Reliance on a Misleading Approach. It was presented at a RAMS, I believe. Anyway, when you realize that, as in shown in that paper, that it has no correlation with the actual failure rates or the causes of failure.
Right. We talked about that. Now, what do you do? How do we recognize that when it's the question is, and it's not a subtle, it's not an easy problem to solve, is if I look to the body of knowledge and I look to textbooks and I look to standards, I see do predictions, right? It's just one example. Ooh. Or make the assume an exponential distribution. It's common. So if I'm new to reliability engineering, my boss says, hey, Fred, you go figure this out, be the reliability guy. And that's what I see. And that's what I see promoted by consultancies and by software packages. Go do a parts count, do a prediction. How do I, at that point, how do I recognize that this doesn't make sense?
Well, it's very simple.
Listen to the podcast.
Unless the company, to me, it's very simple, Fred. If the company has made a product before, or anybody in that company has been in a company that's made a product similar type, and usually companies, you know, are formed by people that have experience in the previous predecessor type product models or other companies that made the same thing. If any of those people go and look at their field failures, or go look at their test failures, or go look at their, well, fundamental and the bottom line is the field, is the real failures, bringing them back in. And it's not always easy to do. You got to realize that sometimes there's, you know, a design mistake, and those people don't want to be identified of being making the error in a design that caused a great rash of fuel
factors. Well, yeah, if the company is going to blame somebody and put them on the, you know, on the block for a mistake, then it just builds a culture where you just don't find failures. You don't assign blame. You don't investigate failures because somebody will get in trouble. Right. And because somebody gets in trouble. But that's a cultural problem that can be changed. But the idea, what you're saying is you need to understand the failures. You need to do the root cause analysis when they fail.
Right. You need to understand the physics, where the failure came from, because it could from the design. It could be an anomaly in the manufacturing and supply chain. And that's very deep. The component manufacturer, the assembly of the circuit board, there's just so many different levels where products can get a component or subsystem can get damaged, or in tests, somebody uses over voltages, you know, something like that.
Repair processes.
There's a thousand reasons.
Yeah.
And so once you start to examine, and it's not all, it's, I tell you, failure analysis is one of the most challenging, because many times when you're trying to disassemble or isolate the component, you sometimes destroy the failure mechanism that you were actually looking for.
Oh, yeah, it's an art. There's definitely an art to doing root cause analysis.
Right. And so the easier thing is to go to a book and do all these equations that have nothing to do with anything and say you did something for reliability.
But that's the crux, is how do you know, right, that going to a book and doing a prediction is meaningless, or making the assumption?
Well, for that reason, if you analyze the field causes of field failures, and if those failures are included in, if those mechanisms and reasons that those failed are in the calculations, or, you know, like they use the Arrhenius equation for semiconductor failures using an activation energy. Okay. Did you find your semiconductors has like an electromigration problem inside, or a hot carrier injection breakdown?
Oh, no, it was just ESD, so we can't find it. So we just assume it's ESD, and that's random.
Another thing.
Yeah, right. That's just random. So it's exponential, and it's a lot of hand waving. So now, Kirk, when I came into reliability work, it was my boss said, hey, can you figure out how long this thing will last? And it was a polymer system, right? It was a polymer system that had electrodes in it, and it would change in resistivity depending on the temperature. So when it got cold, it would become a heater. When it was warm, it would turn off. It was kind of a cool device. And so he said, we need to know if this will last for 20 years. And so I dove into the deep end of reliability engineering, starting with accelerated testing. And I didn't know anything about it. I was a research scientist at that point and had worked on the factory floor. So I knew the process of making these things fairly well. And my boss was very much a mentor in it. He says, well, have you thought about this? Or have you considered that? Have you, you know, what kind of measurement error are you dealing with? Mm-hmm. But we understood that the change in resistivity over time, it wouldn't create as much heat as it used to. And we knew from the polymer scientists and the chemist that it was a oxidation process. And we knew that that was a chemical process.
Okay.
And so we immediately went to the Arrhenius equation. Mm-hmm. And I went to the chemist to find out what the activation energy is, because I read that they had techniques to characterize chemical processes. And so I said, well, I'm not going to guess what the activation energy is. I have a resource over here that could tell me what it is, and then I can design this test. And then he said, now this is a rough estimate. It'll help you get started. But if you design your test appropriately, you can check this assumption that it's the right one.
Right.
And so the books I read were not reliability books, except for Wayne Nelson's book on how to do an accelerated test. It was chemistry books. It was polymer physics books. It was stuff like that.
Well, sure.
And so that carried me forward forever. Is always any problem I ran into, any issue I ran into. But I had my boss and I had resources around me that encouraged me to ask these questions, to get the understanding. And I think that curiosity is what we need to foster in all reliability engineers.
Well,
instead of going to the table and looking it up, or, you know, assuming exponential because it's easy.
The curiosity, right? The curiosity for engineers in wanting to improve reliability to go find out why those products are coming back from the field either failed or showing that they are no fault found, or whatever reason, going through that real data. And it's not easy. It takes a lot of work. You may have to go to a failure analysis lab. You may have to do decapsulation. You may have to do a lot of things. But the motivation to go find out the real causes, the physics behind why that device failed, and then was did it come from the manufacturing chain? Did it come from the design variations or not tolerating the variation in manufacturing? You got to go find that. You got to go down and dig into it.
Right.
I would give, and we just to give the listeners a reference of why we're talking about this, is in the Reliability and Risk Division newsletter, they sent out a sample CRE questions. And all 10 of those questions, not one of them is really about testing or stress testing or life testing or anything like that. There is some kind of, it's mostly statistical. They even go back to the old Arrhenius equation, which is, as we call it, the Arrhenius equation. It has, it's okay. When you talk about that thermistor, I think it was, that would what it'd be, right?
Well, it's a heating cable, but we knew the chemical process in detail.
Right.
Of how it degraded.
Yeah, right. It was very, very specific. And it was on one particular model of that device. Or
Different polymers had different activation energies. Right, definitely.
Exactly. So now you're talking about, when you talk about a semiconductor, you've got, you know, four basic mechanisms that are competing in the semiconductor to wear it out. And those change as the dimensions and the architecture of the semiconductors has been shrinking. Mm-hmm. Those, you know, which is dominant, which is, and I'm sure it's just so complex, but those four, you know, which one's going to be the one to wear it out? And the reality is all of them last longer than you need it to be for the most part.
For the most part. If it's manufactured well.
And if it is, follow the grid design rules for electromigration, for hot carry, the thickness of the insulation, all those things. That's kind of good design practice. But all the engineers, I think, try to do good design practice.
Oh, yeah.
And it's something that, you know, the guy designed that subsystem over there, and he designed this subsystem here. And then when we put the two subsystems together, well, things weren't quite right. You know, everybody didn't quite get precision that they needed to for these two things to interface well.
Well, it comes back to, though, Kirk, what you're talking about is, you know, do decent design practices and check your designs and I mean, put it under some stress and find out where the weaknesses are. But I think all of it is that we're not trying to create a test to find out where hot carry and junk happens unless we're making we're designing ASICs and fabbing them ourselves kind of thing. But if we're buying ASICs and silicon and components and material sets from other folks,
right,
and we put it together, we're looking for the things that catch out our mistaken assumptions in the design process or unknown failure mechanisms that are built into our process and our design and the manufacturing process. It's because it's not going to wear out. If when you're talking about electronics a lot of times, and vast majority of them are going to be just fine for quite a long time. You just really don't need to worry about that. Right. But the issue is that they still fail, and they're not failing they're not failing because of the wear out. They're failing because we didn't mechanically attach it correctly, so it vibrates and it rattles parts off the board, or our manufacturing process is really bad, and so we do a lot of repair work, which damages stuff, you know, things like that. And those are hard to model. Right. You need to go find them.
Well, exactly. That's what my point is.
That's what I wanted to bring out, is I knew where you were going with this, but you get to it. Come on, get to the point here.
Hey, you can't model something you don't know. And that's, you know, this, you don't know. There's so many possible ways for complex electronics to fail. not for this one device, not for one component, but for all the combined, and it's the application of that component. The component mm-hmm. intrinsic wear out is very dependent on where it's being used, how it's being used. Mm-hmm. I mean, and for sure, you mentioned it the last time we talked about a chemical reaction, and that's critical to batteries. I mean, that's everything to batteries. Yeah.
So the point is that
problem
I mean,
with batteries.
We're talking about the problem again. Well, what do we do? I mean, I'm suggesting is be curious, is get to the root cause. And you're saying as you have failures, understand them to the root cause. Now, there's a secondary problem here, Kirk, is you and I were given the luxury of learning these techniques and the space and time to dig into the details and do the root cause and do the deeper understanding of it. I don't know that many organizations today that have that luxury, that have chemists on staff or have a failure analysis lab or budget to do lab stuff. Because we have to be able to justify that instead of doing a 2-hour pencil exercise to estimate reliability, why don't we go figure out where the failures are and justify that I need to spend 8 hours, you know, in the lab understanding this failure mechanism. That's the hard part, I think, in solving this problem is justifying the need to understand the failures.
Justifying the need to understand the failures.
Right.
Well, there's a cost to failures. You could make a business case for it. You could look at what the failure rate in the field is and say, this is costing us this much in warranty plus, you know, we never can say what lost sales and future reputation is going to cost us, but it's killed companies. Okay. That, you know, a failure of a product has killed companies. Right. I think that it can be extreme cost to the company and that can be shown. Also, you can take product from the field. It takes quite a challenge to go against the massive established culture of this misleading approach. You go take a product and you can go, if you know enough about it, or a little, you have a potential suspicion that this is driving the failure, you can go put it in a chamber and use that stress or, you know, voltage. And there's some that don't require a chamber, and that is voltage, frequency marching. There's a lot of things that don't require a chamber or vibration. But the best is to do it under thermal, you know, make a hypothesis. A hypothesis of what the mechanism might be from your field data and what you can best ascertain from the field data, and then take some of your products, you know, and depending on the failure rate, you may have to use a lot of them, but go and put them into stress, and you might be, and there's a good chance in some of them, depending on that failure rate in the field, you're going to find that mechanism in the chamber.
And that's one of the tenets.
Stress doesn't lie.
No.
Stress doesn't lie.
It's one of the elements of doing a root cause analysis is you need to be able to replicate the problem. You need to, it's difficult, especially with transient type failures or intermittent type failures. But the idea is that if you see a symptom of failure mode, can you replicate it? And then can you turn it on and off? And that provides a path towards, well, what do we need to solve? How do we break this chain of this mechanism causing this problem?
So you've got to stimulate it to reproduce that mechanism, okay, many times. You can't fix something that's not broken. If it sits there and works correctly on a bench, you can't. But,
You can. You can throw lots of money and say, make it better. And nobody knows what to make better. But if you give an engineer enough time and money, they will make it better.
If they understand why it's worse,
they'll have estimates. But it's so much more efficient.
Well, they've got to know what to fix.
Well, they don't. No, you don't. You just change everything and you hopefully make it more robust. I've seen people doing that, right? But it's so much more efficient when you say, hey, you know, this part has a metal fatigue because of this vibrational load that it's getting. We need to figure out a way to support it better, you know, or find a solution to this problem. But if we have a specific failure mechanism and understanding of that mechanism, it's a whole lot easier to solve the problem and actually solve the problem rather than shotgun guessing.
Well, exactly. And that's why we disagree about derating. I consider derating, following a derating guideline in a general way, just what the book says, is a shotgun method that, yes, you might put in a component that needed more margin on it by having higher, less of its rated usage. But again, and it may be more of an expensive way, but in some ways it's a more difficult way, and that is to go stress it thermally.
Well, I don't think it's more expensive. I disagree with that. I think it's
a weak point.
But okay. I look at, and we've talked about this before. But let's get back to it. The idea here, I think, is that as a reliability professional, one of our roles is to help the rest of our team understand how they can achieve the objectives they want. They want a low failure rate over the warranty period, or they want to improve customer satisfaction. And they also want to make a product that's, doesn't cost an arm and a leg. One of the most efficient things we can do is just as you're saying, Kirk, is you need to be exceedingly curious about why things fail. And what we're talking about there is do the root cause analysis, understand it, get to the basics of this stuff. And it's the fascinating part of what we do, is we get into material science, we get into manufacturing processes, we get into all kinds of cool stuff. But it's that knowledge that we can uncover and share with our team that enables them to actually make a better product. And as experience goes, then you can move that experience into design practices and guidelines and stuff But the idea, the fundamental thing is that it's not all in the books. Our textbooks and our practices and so on are just all too often replicating what we've been doing since the 60s. And they're spinning it with new names every now and then, and we've got new materials that cause new problems and stuff like that.
Well,
but I think
I'm not sure I agree.
Well, your book doesn't.
Rules. No, wait. For it's a design for manufacturability. Simple things like use the same size screws
everywhere.
Around.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No. There's lots of good stuff,
that's in the book to tell you to do.
But that's not reliability
practices.
Right. But no. It's not.
It relates to reliability.
It leads to reliability. It does have influence. But if you open up O'Connor and Kleiner's book on practical reliability engineering, which is the best-selling book in the reliability field, it's full of exponential distribution, MTBFs, parts count prediction methodologies, and a bunch of that stuff. And that's the book that most people go to because it's the book.
Because they haven't read my book, Next Generation Halt and Hass, where most of the
I was just setting you up for that.
Electronics and systems, okay?
That's right. The link will be below.
They read my book, which has 7 5-star reviews. All of my reviews are 5-star.
There you go.
They say, I take the thing and I just rip that. First of all, I want to rip away from the reliability prediction crap that keeps going on. And then next say, look, we got to go investigate. There are some stress strength distributions that you had to be concerned about. But the way to find mistakes that nobody saw is to go stress test it to a operation or sometimes a destruct limit.
Yeah, I like breaking it myself. That's where I go. So the point we've summarized it, Kirk. We don't want to have to repeat it. The basic idea is go find failures and then understand them. It's really that simple. And there's lots of other things we can do that improve processes and stability and design practice, all kinds of stuff we can do, but it all comes to understanding the failures. We really need to understand failure mechanisms and where and how they occur.
Right. And so, that can be very product dependent.
So instead
That's of very product dependent many times.
Right. And so instead of spending a bunch of time looking up tables, is go get books on material science of why things fail. Or just do stuff like that. Be curious, I think, is my final say on it. So in general, though, if you're listening to this and, we know it's a problem. Kirk and I talked about it in the last episode and touched on it a bit here, is that there's so much old information of stuff that really is not helpful for you or your reliability program. So we've outlined a couple of things to do different from that. So what do you do to recognize that, yeah, this tool is not really helping me here. It's an activity, but it's not really helping. Or what challenges are you facing in order to do failure analysis, for example? Let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a contact form there. Kirk and I and the other hosts are available through our About pages and on LinkedIn. So we really, really do enjoy hearing from you.
Fred?
Yeah.
Can I close?
Yeah, go for it. Well, go for it.
Okay.
If it's short, if you're not going to repeat
everything.
You guys,
I know you're going to turn off your car and get out of the car soon.
That's right.
Here.
That's right.
But from Charles Darwin, it is not the strongest of the species that survives. Not the most intelligent that survives.
Well, good. That's good.
It is the one that is most adaptable to change. And I don't see the world of electronics, reliability, engineering doing the change they need to do at the same rate that electronics is changing. So I hope there's young people, and we want to hear from you on what you think you can do to make a change happen. Thank you.
Yeah, excellent said. Thanks, Kirk. We'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure.
Thank you, Fred.
All right, cheers.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.